The following reading is from chapter 12 of The Mortification of Sin by John Owen. Practice self-abasement and consideration of your own vileness before the majesty of God. O Lord, I have heard the report of you and your work. O Lord, do I fear. I hear and my body trembles, my lips quiver at the sound. Rottenness enters into my bones, my legs tremble beneath me. Habakkuk 3 verses 1 and 16. Eighthly, meditate on the sort of things that help you to grasp your unworthiness before the majesty of God, such as the following. Number 1, think deeply and frequently about the excellence of the majesty of God and your infinite, inconceivable distance from Him. Pondering the excellence and majesty of God ought to fill you with a clear sense of your own vileness, which strikes at the very root of indwelling sin. When Job comes to a clear understanding of the greatness and excellency of God, he is filled with self-loathing and humiliation. Job 42, 5 and 6. And what does Habakkuk say of himself when he sees the majesty of God? Habakkuk 3:16, with God is terrible majesty, says Job, Job 37, verse 22. Similarly, many other ancient men and women throughout the scriptures also exclaimed when they saw God that they were likely to die. The scriptures are abundant in this kind of self-abasing consideration, comparing men to grasshoppers, to vanity, the dust of the balance. Next to God. Isaiah 40:12-25. Spend a lot of time meditating on thoughts like this to diminish the pride in your heart and to humble your soul. There is nothing that will make you less inclined to be lured away by the deceitfulness of sin than such a frame of heart. Think greatly of the greatness of God. Number 2, think deeply and frequently of your lack of familiarity with Him. You may know enough to keep you low and humble, and yet you still know so little of Him. This kind of thinking casts a wise proverb writer into the sort of understanding of himself, which he expresses this way: surely I am too stupid to be a man. I do not have the understanding of a man. I have not learned wisdom, nor do I have knowledge of the Holy One. Who has ascended to heaven and come down? Who has gathered the wind in his fists? Who has wrapped up the waters in a garment? Who has established all the ends of the earth? What is his name and what is his son's name? Surely you know. Proverbs 30 verses 2 to 4. Use this as well to take down the pride of your heart. What do you know about God? How little is your knowledge? How immense is He in His nature? Can you look without terror into the abyss of eternity? You cannot bear the rays of His glorious being. This idea is extremely useful in our walking with God. It is consistent with the boldness that comes from our adoption as sons and daughters of God, which we have in Jesus Christ, to draw near to the throne of grace. Hebrews 4 verse 16. Therefore, I will further elaborate on it and recommend it in order to make it stick on the hearts of any who desire to walk humbly with God. Therefore, consider that even people who are highest in their worship and deepest in their communion and fellowship with God still have very little knowledge of Him and His glory in this life. Let that thought keep your heart in continual awe of the majesty of God. God reveals His name to Moses, the most glorious attributes that He has manifested in the covenant of grace. Exodus 34, verses 5 and 6. And yet these are only the back parts of God. All that Moses knows is minuscule compared to the perfections of His glory. John compares Moses to Christ, John 1, verse 17. Says, no man has seen God at any time. John 1 verse 18. He is making a specific reference to Moses. Not even Moses, the most eminent saint among us, has seen God at any time. We speak a lot about God. We talk of his ways, works, and counsels all day long. Yet in truth, we know very little of him. Our thoughts and expressions of him are very basic. Many of them are unworthy of his glory, and none of them reach his perfections. Objection. You will say that Moses was under the law when God wrapped up himself in darkness and showed himself to Moses only in types and clouds and veiled institutions. But under the glorious shining of the gospel, which has brought life and immortality to light, and since God has revealed himself in Christ, we now know him much more clearly and as he is. We see his face now and not just his back parts as Moses did. Answer 1. There is a vast difference, an almost inconceivable difference, between the relationship we now have with God after his speaking to us by his own Son, Hebrews 1 verse 2, and the relationship most of the saints had under the law. But their eyes were as good, sharp, and clear as ours. Their faith and spiritual understanding were not inferior to ours. God, the object of faith, was as glorious to them as he is to us. Yet our time is more clear than theirs. The clouds are blown away and scattered, Song of Solomon 4 verse 6. The shadows of the night are gone and fled away. The sun has risen, and the means of sight is more near and clear than in their time. 2, the unique sight Moses had of God, Exodus 34, was still a gospel sight. A sight of God as gracious and so on, and yet what Moses saw was called God's back parts. That is low and insignificant compared to his true excellencies and perfections. 3, the Apostle Paul exalted to the utmost the glory of light the gospel has above that of the law, showing that now the veil causing darkness is taken away, 2 Corinthians 3, verses 13 to 16, so that with uncovered face we behold the glory of the Lord, 2 Corinthians 3, 18. Then he tells us how we now see as in a mirror, 1 Corinthians 13, verse 12. In a mirror. What is that like? Clearly? Perfectly? Sadly, no. On the contrary, he tells you, we see in a mirror dimly. 1 Corinthians 13, verse 12. This mirror Paul speaks of is not a telescope that helps us to see things that are far away. And telescopes are not even that helpful. We still fall quite short of seeing things as they truly are despite their assistance. Rather, it is a mirror that Paul means. There are only obscure reflections and images of things that are represented, not the things themselves. He compares the sight of those reflections to our sight and knowledge of God's glory in the gospel. He is saying that everything that we do see by way of this mirror is in a riddle, in darkness and obscurity. He even includes himself, though he saw more clearly than any living person, saying he saw only in part. He saw only the back parts of the heavenly things, verse 12, and compares all the knowledge he had gained of God to his knowledge of things when he was a child, verse 11. The knowledge we have right now is only a part short of the fulfillment, and when the fulfillment comes, it shall be destroyed. We know how children often have weak, feeble, and uncertain notions and understandings of difficult concepts. And when they grow up and are educated and become skilled, those old ways of thinking vanish, and they are embarrassed of them. A child who loves, honors, believes, and obeys his father does well. But because of his father's superior knowledge and understanding, his father knows his remaining childishness and foolishness. Despite all our confidence of high understanding, all our conceptions of God are childish compared to the realities of his infinite perfections. In our most accurate, as we think, notions of God, for the most part, we merely lisp and babble and say all sorts of silly things we don't understand fully. Likewise, we may love, honor, believe, and obey our Father, and he accepts our childish thoughts, for they are merely childish. We only see his back parts. We know very little about him. For this reason, we are comforted and supported by the promise that we shall see him as he is. We will see him face to face. We will know as we are known. Understand that for which we are understood, 1 Corinthians 13, verse 12, 1 John 3, verse 2. And finally, now we do not see him, 1 Peter 1, verse 8. From all these we conclude that here we see only his back parts. We do not see him as he is, but in a dark, obscure representation, not in the perfection of his glory. Number 4. The Queen of Sheba had heard a lot about Solomon and had imagined what his magnificence was like. But when she came and saw his glory, she was forced to confess that she had not heard even half of the truth. 1 Kings 10, verse 7. We may think that we have attained great knowledge in this life, that we have clear and high thoughts about God, but alas, when he brings us into his presence, we will cry out, "We never knew him as he is. We never understood even with thousands of his glory and perfection and blessedness." Number 5. The Apostle John tells us that we do not know what we ourselves will be in the end. 1 John 3, verse 2. Much less will we have any clue what God is or what he is like. Consider either him who is to be known or how we know him, and this becomes clear. We know little about God because God cannot be fully known. We know so little about God because it is God who is the one we are trying to know. That is, God describes himself by saying that we cannot know him. What else could he mean when he calls himself incomprehensible and so on? Of course, he means we cannot fully know him as he is. Our further progress consists more in knowing what he is not than what he is. Thus, he is described to be immortal, infinite. That is, he is not as we are, mortal, finite, and limited. This is why that glorious description of him who alone has immortality, who dwells in unapproachable light, who no man has ever seen nor can see. 1 Timothy 6, verse 16. His light is such that no creature can approach him. He is not seen, not because he cannot be seen, but because we cannot bear the sight of him. The light of God, in whom there is no darkness, forbids all access to him by any creature whatsoever. We who cannot look at the sun and its glory are too weak to bear the beams of infinite brightness. Considering this, a wise man considered himself too stupid to be a man, and have not the understanding of a man, Proverbs 30, verse 2. That is, he knew nothing in comparison to God, so that he seemed to have lost all his understanding when he considered God, his work, and his ways. With this general idea in mind, let us now descend to some particular points first. Our knowledge of God is so far from being accurate that to attempt to explain him in normal ways is effectively idol worship. Indeed, we are so far from true knowledge of God that all we can do in attempt to instruct one another in it is to make expressions and explanations of it that frame concepts of it in our minds based on impressions and images that we derive from how we know other things. Yet when we do that, we end up making an idol to ourselves and worshiping a God of our own making and not the God who made us. We might as well be justified in whittling him out of wood or stone if we are going to form him as a being in our minds that we can understand. The highest and best thoughts we can have of the being of God is that we can have no thoughts of it. Our knowledge of a being is properly low when it attempts to rise no higher than to know that we do not know it. Number 2, we do not even fully comprehend even the things God has taught us how to explain. There may be some attributes of God which he himself has taught us how to explain and has given us some help in controlling our expressions of them. Yet, when we have crafted our expressions and explanations, we still do not truly see the things themselves or understand them at all. We simply are able to believe and admire. These things teach us to profess that God is infinite, omnipotent, and eternal. We know what sort of disputes and notions there are about omnipresence, immensity, infiniteness, and eternity. We have words and concepts for these things, but do we really truly know them? Can the mind of any man do anything but be overwhelmed by an infinite abyss? Can it do more than just give itself up to what it cannot conceive, much less express? Isn't our understanding of these things actually brutish in our thinking of God's attributes and is almost non-existent? Indeed, to perfect our understanding is to not understand and to rest there. We have merely a glimpse of the back parts of eternity and infiniteness. What should I even say regarding the Trinity or the subsistence of distinct persons in the same individual essence? Many deny this mystery because no one understands it. Every letter of it is mysterious. Who can explain how the Son is begotten of the Father, and what way the Spirit proceeds from the Father, or the difference between the one and the other? I shall not further elaborate on particulars. The infinite and inconceivable distance that is between him and us keeps us in the dark regarding any sight of his face or clear apprehension of his perfections. We know him by what he does rather than by what he is, by his doing good to us rather than by his essential goodness, and how little is the portion we actually perceive of him. We know little about God because we only know him through faith alone. I will not go on at length about how all men have an abiding impression in their hearts that there is a God, nor what they might deduce about God from his works in creation and providence which they may observe. We must confess that it is so low, across the woeful experience of all ages, so weak, low, dark, and confused, that no one ever by reason and observation truly glorified God as they ought. Indeed, despite their knowledge of God, they were without God in the world, Ephesians 2, verse 12. The primary and really only acquaintance we have with God in his revelations of himself is by faith. Whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists and rewards those who seek him, Hebrews 11:6. Our knowledge of him and the gifts he gives, the foundation of our obedience or coming to him, is believing. We walk by faith and not by sight, 2 Corinthians 5:7. By faith, and so much by faith that we have no clear idea, image, or category for that which we believe. Faith is the only argument we have for things not seen, Hebrews 11, verse 1. Here I will elaborate upon the nature of it and show from all the things that accompany it that we all know are nearly the back parts of what we can only know by faith. Regarding where faith comes from, it is built purely on the testimony of him whom we have not seen. As Peter says, how can you love him whom you have not seen? 1 Peter 1, verse 8. That is, him whom you know only by faith that he exists. Faith accepts everything, including Christ, based on his testimony alone. Regarding faith's nature, it is an affirmation of a testimony, not evidence from a demonstration. And the object of it is beyond our understanding. This is why our faith is described as seeing dimly as in a mirror. All that we know this way and all that we know about God we know this way is small, dark, and obscure. Objection. At this point you will say, all this is true, but only for those who do not know God as he is revealed in Jesus Christ. It is different for those who do know him. The scripture says, no man has seen God at any time, yet the only begotten Son, he has revealed him, John 1, verse 18. And the Son of God has come and has given us understanding so that we may know him who is true. 1 John 5, 20. The light of the glorious gospel of Christ, who is the image of God, shines on believers. 2 Corinthians 4, verse 4. Indeed, God, who commanded the light to shine out of darkness, has shone into our hearts to give the light of the knowledge of the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. Verse 6. God does so, that though at one time you were darkness, but now you are light in the Lord. Paul tells us, we all with unveiled face behold the glory of the Lord. 2 Corinthians 3, verse 18. We are now so removed from this darkness and are now so much closer to God that our fellowship is with the Father and with the Son, 1 John 1, verse 3. The light of the gospel by which God is now revealed is glorious. It is not a star, but the sun in its beauty that has risen over us, and the veil has been taken from our faces. Although unbelievers and perhaps some weak believers may be in some darkness, but those of any growth or considerable progress now have a clear sight and view of the face of God in Jesus Christ. Answer. Number one, the truth is, all of us know enough of him to love him more than we do, to delight in him and serve him, believe him, obey him, put our trust in him above all that we have so far attained. Our darkness and weakness are no excuse for our negligence and disobedience. Who can say he has lived up to the knowledge that he has had of the perfections, excellence, and will of God? God's purpose in giving us any knowledge of himself here is that we may glorify him as God, Romans 1, verse 21. That is, love him, serve him, believe him, obey him, and give him all the honor and glory that he deserves from poor sinful creatures to a sin-pardoning God and Creator. We must acknowledge that we are not yet fully transformed into the image of that knowledge we have received. If we had used our talents well, we might have been entrusted with more. Number two. When compared to the revelation of God in the Old Testament or any other source of knowledge of God that might be available, the knowledge of God we have through the revelation of Jesus Christ in the gospel is outstanding and glorious. The Old Testament law revealed only the shadow of good things, not the exact image of them. Paul discusses this at length in 2 Corinthians 3. But Christ has now in these last days revealed the Father from his own person, declared his name, made known his mind, will, and counsel in a far more clear, exalted, and distinct manner than he did under the law. Number three, the difference between believers and unbelievers regarding knowledge does not have so much to do with the manner of their knowledge as it does the manner of their knowing. Some unbelievers may know more and be able to say more about God, his perfections, and his will than many believers. Yet they do not know any of it as they should. Nothing spiritually and in a way that can save their souls. Nothing with a holy heavenly understanding. The excellence of a believer is not that he has a large understanding of things, but that what he does understand, though it might be very little, he sees in the light of the Spirit of God and a saving soul transforming light. This is what gives us communion with God, not intellectual curiosity. Number four, Jesus Christ by his word and spirit reveals God as a Father, as a God in covenant, and as a rewarder to the hearts of all who believe. He does it sufficiently to teach us to obey him here and to lead us into his presence and to enjoy him there for eternity. Still, all of this is just a little portion that we know of him. We still only see his back parts. This is because gospel revelation is only meant to reveal enough of God to draw us to him in faith. The intention of all gospel revelation is not to unveil God's essential glory so that we should see him as he is, but rather to declare only so much of him as he knows is enough to provide a foundation for our faith, love, obedience, and coming to him. That is only enough to provide for the faith that he expects from us in this life, and for the kind of services appropriate for poor creatures in the midst of temptations. But when he calls us to eternal admiration and contemplation, without interruption, he will make a new way of revealing himself to us in the whole shape of things as we now see it. Will depart as a shadow. Number two, we are slow of heart to receive the things that are revealed in the Word. Through our infirmity and weakness, God keeps us in continual dependence on Him for teaching and revelation of Himself out of His Word. He never in this world brings any soul to the height of what can be drawn out and understood from the Word. So that although the way of revelation and the gospel is very clear and evident, we still don't understand much about the things themselves that are revealed. We should therefore continually consider the inconceivable greatness of God and our infinite distance from Him. If we were to do so, would the thoughts not so fill the soul with such a holy and awful fear of Him as to keep our hearts as poor soil for the cultivation of any sin at all? Train your soul to habitually ponder God's greatness and omnipresence, and it will be on its guard against inappropriate behaviors. Consider Him with whom you have to deal. Our God is a consuming fire, Hebrews 12, verse 29. And your greatest shame in His presence and sight, know that your very nature is too limited to understand His essential glory.